You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Learn, lean, lead. This is the concept behind much of Dr. Bryant Cameron Webb's philosophy of medicine and social justice. Dr. Webb is an assistant professor at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, where he is the director of health policy and equity in the school's Department of Public Health Sciences. Dr. Webb is visiting Idaho as part of a statewide health summit that's taking place in Boise. And Dr. Webb is joining me in studio to talk more. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the first question for you, talk to me a little bit about the intersection of medicine and social justice, because they really are interconnected.
Oh, very much so. And you know, it's interesting because today you make that statement, they're very interconnected. Mm-hmm. And we kind of take that as a fact. But if you went back 20, 25 years, I think people would have pushed back a little bit. They thought that health happened in the clinic, and that was the entire paradigm. You know, that health happened in those spaces where doctors are taking care of patients. But in reality, what I like to say is that health happens where we're born, grow, live, learn, eat, play, and pray. Those are the spaces where the great majority of your health outcomes are going to be determined. And so as a physician, if I'm just looking at those 15 minutes of time that I have in a clinic visit or the couple of days somebody's admitted to my hospital, I'm going to miss all the real factors that are shaping your health outcomes. And so I think that's where we as providers or folks in medicine really need to be attuned to the social justice piece, because it's things like income inequality and education and transportation and housing that are really impacting the health of our populations.
When do you think the change started happening? Because you're absolutely right that 20, 25 years ago, it was all about what the doctor told you in the doctor's office, and you either followed it or you didn't.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. You know, the academic in me says that there were some seminal reports that were kind of commissioned by Congress in the early 2000s that shed light on the fact that, you know, we don't provide the best quality healthcare in the United States, and the reason is because it was so inequitable. And at the same time, we had the Human Genome Project that showed us that we were more similar between races and ethnicities than we were within races and ethnicities. So then in terms of our genes. So so it begged a couple of questions. It's not genes that are driving these differences in health outcomes. What was it? And we know that race is a social construct. And so in the world of disparities, we started to say, well, what are the other social constructs that are creating these differences that we see? And I think there's just a bunch of research that came out in the years thereafter. There was a report from the then Institutes of Medicine called Unequal Treatment that really showed us a lot of what we saw in terms of bias and its impact on health outcomes. And piece by piece, we started unpacking it. And we learned what some other parts of the world already knew, which was that, like I said, health happens in the space where we are. Your zip code determines your health more than your genetic code.
Right. And I remember seeing a report about a major United States city. I cannot specifically remember which one, maybe Detroit, Chicago, where they talked about food deserts. And this is a newer concept.
Yeah.
But that here you are in a major city, and this was, of course, in a more African-American community.
Right.
Yet they had no access to a grocery store. And so then people's health outcomes weren't as good.
Yeah, you know, it was probably Chicago. That's where kind of that coin was, or that term was really coined by a group, Mari Gallagher, out in Chicago. And what they found was that there were these spaces where people just didn't have access to retail food stores. And it's interesting because I went back and tried to do some digging. This doesn't happen by accident. I actually don't use the term food deserts often because you think things like the Sahara, that's a desert. That's naturally occurring, right?
Right.
This is a food apartheid. This was designed. Huh. It was structured. It was created by policies and practices. And so what's interesting about it is that in Chicago in particular, there were grocery stores in some of those neighborhoods initially. But what happened is that because Chicago was so segregated, as affluent blacks left the black communities and went to the suburbs, you didn't have kind of the income levels to continue to help grocery stores to make those margins. So they make their money off of the items like, you know, paper towels and mops and brooms and all those other things. And so you didn't have people buying those extra items anymore because the wealthier residents or the more affluent residents were leaving. And so the grocery stores left too. And it became hard for somebody else to come in because they're like, we're not going to make money.
So we're not going to come in.
And what Chicago ultimately had to do was really speak to grocers, to Walmart in particular, and say, hey, what can we do to get you into this neighborhood in Austin or these other parts of Chicago to bring you in? So just the same way that these are not accidents, not deserts, but they're created by policy, we can fix them with policy. And that's what's important. Health is in all of our policies.
And I think what's interesting about that is when we look at here in Idaho, for example. So, you know, we're located in Boise, the program is, but you go 20 miles down the road to Nampa, and they have found that there are, you know, food deserts, food apartheid, as you call them, in areas of Idaho.
Yeah.
And we do not have a large African American population, but we are rural, and we definitely have equity issues when it comes to income.
Well, and I think what's important to note is that we're seeing a couple of different versions of the same thing. All roads lead to people not having access to the food they need to stay healthy, but it can be because there aren't grocery stores, or it can be because grocery stores are far away, or it could be because the food is unaffordable. You know, there are so many different reasons why people don't have access to healthy food, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, those sorts of things. And so just the same as, you know, we look at and say we diagnose what's the real problem here in our communities, we have to design strategies for rural communities that are different than, you know, the retail food environment in a more urban environment. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where, you know, doing that tough work of saying, well, what's driving the issue here in our community when we look at our rates of food insecurity? What's the cause, and how do we craft a policy strategy to address it? So,
because when we look at the Treasure Valley, I know, and taking Nampa as an example, is its access, because there are a lot of elderly people in a certain part of that city that no longer drive.
Right.
So what's been fascinating about that is they put a grassroots effort together with professors and churches, other educational institutions, and basically have a van.
Right.
And they pick up people and take them to the grocery store. But what they found is it's a social outlet as well,
right,
which has affected people's health. Have you seen that too?
That's huge. Well, absolutely. And, you know, there's a similar phenomenon with community gardening, how you can get fresh fruits and vegetables just by having, you know, taking over vacant lots, terraforming them and growing fresh fruits and vegetables for young kids. It teaches them about fruits and vegetables. And the reality is if aunts and grandmothers and whomever are out in the garden somewhere, there's less, you know, social discord, there's less violence, there's less chaos, because, you know, these gardens are places of healing, you know. And so I think that's been kind of an interesting phenomenon that we've seen. There are positive unintended consequences or things that weren't necessarily the goal, but they definitely have a great impact. So that's awesome that they're doing that work, you know, right here. And I think that's how it starts. It has to start at that grassroots level of recognizing what's going on with your neighbor and saying, how can I be helpful? And I think so often we look for these top-down approaches. What I usually tell folks is that, you know, health is one of the symptoms of challenges, or health outcomes, one of the symptoms of challenges in our communities. We see it manifest in health in a certain way, in terms of excess rates of cardiovascular disease, or more cancer mortality, or whatever it may be. And we start to think, oh, these people are sicker. No, these communities are sicker, and there are reasons for that. And so, you know, just the same, communities all over the country are standing up and saying, this is what we need, and this is how we can fix it. And I think it's critical for healthcare providers to lean in and say, how can we be a good partner in that?
I'm speaking with Dr. Bryant Cameron Webb about medicine and social justice. He is in Idaho for a medicine and social justice summit. You brought up a good point about medical, you know, institutions, hospitals, other community partners having to come together to really fix this issue. Because as you mentioned, and we're seeing this more and more, is it is really about your zip code.
Right.
Not about your genetic makeup, but your zip code. But at the same time, all of the responsibility can't be placed just on a doctor and a hospital, I would think.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's one of the areas where I get the most pushback from providers, is they say this is what we call mission creep in most spaces.
Okay.
We say, you know, as doctors, you know, I went to school for all these years to learn how to treat illness, to cure illness, and I'm doing my best. But if you also heap all of society's problems on the mission of medicine, it's pretty challenging, you know? And I think that that's where my response is, that it's not about solving the problem yourself. It's about being a good partner, playing in the sandbox, understanding that you've got a role to play just like you know, other entities do. And how can you leverage your networks, your opportunities to help communities just the same as the folks who work in kind of food insecurity or housing instability, and realize, hey, we're all playing the same game here. We're about people work. It's not health work. It's people work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we learn how to really play our role in society in a new and different way.
And let's talk about housing, because I know that can be something that people don't want to put together with medicine and with health. But housing, especially in a place like Idaho and Boise in particular, we are the fastest growing city in the United States. Our housing rates have gone up exponentially. And there are people that cannot even afford a one-bedroom apartment in the capital city of Idaho anymore. Whereas you go back 10, 15, 20 years, this was an incredibly affordable place to live. That is flipping. That is turning. How does that have an impact if you don't know where you're going to live, or you're going, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, which, by the way, 80% of Americans are.
Right.
How does that play into your health?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the simplest way to put it is housing is health, you know, and we say that because there are a couple of mechanisms by which housing impacts health. And we say there's unhealthy housing and there's inadequate housing. Mm-hmm. Unhealthy housing is going to be housing where you have, let's say, mold or pests or those sorts of things. And there's a lot of that around the country that causes increased asthma rates. We know that unhealthy housing is bad for you. Inadequate housing for a lot of people can be that you don't have, you know, working toilet, running water, the sorts of things that you need. Also, still, huge problems there. But, you know, I also look at it from the impact on your income. You know, we talk about housing instability as just being someone who's spending, you know, in most cases, we define it as 30% of their income on housing. That's a lot of people. And especially when housing rates are growing quickly. And I think the way to frame it for folks is that when people are paying 40, 50% of their income on housing, they're forced to make really untenable decisions. And we call it that heat or eat decision, right? Am I going to pay for heating my home, or am I going to eat? Am I going to pay for, you know, this rent, or am I going to buy the medications that my doctor's prescribing me? It has a direct impact on health, even from the economics of it. And so I think that that's where affordable housing becomes so critical, because it has an impact on all the other ways that we live our lives, and things that seem more expendable or something that might have its impact down the road. We start to say, okay, well, I'll forego that for now.
What's interesting to me about this is then the conversations that are had are top level. Mm-hmm. These are CEOs of corporations who don't have to make those choices. And is that a hard conversation to have? Do people at those levels understand truly how this impacts their community? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think they do. I think what people there are a couple of challenges, and one of them is people's sense of whose responsibility it is to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just to be frank, there's this notion of kind of, we talk about American exceptionalism, but this is that place. We are that nation where you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you find a way, and it takes, you know, a couple generations to work your way out of poverty. But, you know, that person who's the CEO, they may have had a family experience over generations where, yes, we were lower income at some point in time, but my grandfather did this and my father did that. And I think that's just part of the natural American experience. And I think I shift that conversation a little bit, and I say that, you know, we're not all having the same American experience. And the reality is, while, you know, some generations have worked their way out, for a lot of people, a lot of demographics across our country, it's just that much harder because there are structural and systematic circumstances that keep people from progressing. And that sounds tough for some people to understand, but it absolutely plays out in our educational system with the way that we track students. It plays out in so many spaces. And so I think helping people understand that, listen, we're not all playing the same game. And it's hard to pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have boots, or if your boots don't have straps.
There you know? Go. Yeah.
So it makes it a little more challenging.
I really want to thank you for the conversation today. It's so important to be having the conversation, because without it, I don't think we can move forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much. My guest today, Dr. Bryant Cameron Webb, been talking about medicine and social justice. Dr. Webb is in town for a health summit looking at just that, how medicine and social justice intertwine. Thank you again for the conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.